This episode is brought to you by Mutinex Growth OS,
the marketing mix modeling platform that makes measuring ROI fast, easy, and cost effective. And this is my best radio voice.
That's the most creative thing you've ever said.
How's this for a call to action?
Mutinex Growth OS, your best decisions start here. Request a demo at mutinex.co. That's mutinex.co.
You were not making wallpaper. I think wallpaper is the worst thing you can make, and 80% of what we make, unfortunately, becomes wallpaper, and then we sort of talk ourselves into going, oh yeah, that's good. No one gives a fuck about advertising, right?
that's a great place to start.
Welcome to another episode of Black T-Shirts. Today on the show, we have Samira Ansari. She's the Chief Creative Officer of one of the biggest and most storied ad agencies in the world, Ogilvy New York. That's a long way from her upbringing as an Iranian immigrant in the outer suburbs of Melbourne. But you can hear that upbringing in her no bullshit approach and her creative fearlessness with her rally cry to people that work for her to go rogue. It's awesome to have her infectious energy on the show. Here's our chat with Samira.
Hi, Samira. Welcome to the show. Are you wearing a black T-shirt?
You know, I it's not entirely black. There's some colour. There's a little bit of purple. But yes, I'm always in black.
Always in black?
You're not, it's not a T-shirt, though. You're I can see it. That's not a T-shirt. What is it?
As Americans would call it, it's a sweater.
Black is your colour in your profile shots, and you like a fair bit of black.
Listen, I'm from Melbourne, right? So it started there, and then New York, black is also the colour. So you always know if you're showing up to, say, a judging event, you know, if you're doing the one show and a Clio and you go into the building and you just look around to work out where you're going, you see the sort of mass of people wearing black standing in a corner and looking somewhat useless, you know, that you have to go join that crowd to then go into a room.
Why do you think creative people are drawn to black?
Because that's one less decision you have to kind of make and stress over, you know, like as an art director, you have to look. I quietly judge art directors if they don't know how to art direct themselves, right?
Yeah. I'm married to one. So I live in an art directed house. I mean, I know how that goes. I know how that goes.
When you see people wearing black versus not, what does that say about them?
Black is nothing, right? So you don't judge. But if they're not wearing black, you better damn well look good.
You better pull it off. Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Samira, you grew up in Iran?
Yes.
And you went to school there?
I did. I was there until I was about 12. So I started sort of the seventh grade or eighth grade, actually. Yeah, right. In Australia.
paint a picture of what it was like being, first of all, a child growing up in Iran, and then what the transition was like to Australia.
Look, it's funny. If people ask me what my childhood was like, and I always say it was kind of like the Wonder Years. So my parents were very good at sort of keeping us protected from the craziness that was going on, because during, you know, it was the Iran and Iraq war, and there were missiles falling on our heads, and sirens would go off and electricity would go off, and we'd all rush down to the basement. But while that was going on, I still had a crush on the boy next door and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, like I'm still a 12-year-old. So in that sense, I have my parents to thank for. But it was different. We went from Tehran, one of the most populated dense cities in the world, to Japan. And we spent, I think, a few weeks in Japan in the transition. Again, another really high-rise-y, dense Tokyo city in the world. And then we landed at Melbourne Airport. And I just remember, like, the look on my mom's face was like, oh, dear God, like, where are we? Because then we got in a car and we drove, you know. But it was amazing. Melbourne's amazing. Australia, I love it. It's home, best place to grow up. Multicultural. I never felt, you know, I was the ESL kid, obviously, but with a whole bunch of other ESL kids, and I didn't really feel the transition wasn't hard. At least I don't remember it being hard. I'm sure it was for a 12-year-old, but it was super welcoming and awesome. I love it.
And just going back to Iran for a minute, it's sort of interesting to me that now you work in advertising. Was you know, growing up in Iran, were brands a big part of your childhood? Was advertising a big part of, you know, being a kid in Iran?
You know, no, because there was no television, right? From the Islamic Republic of Iran, like there was nothing to, everything was censored, so there was nothing to watch. But oddly enough, there was a lot of weird Japanese Hiroshima movies. So I remember watching a lot of like black and white Japanese films. But it did help me become very creative. I, at 11, sort of made up a language or was always very creative, making things, doing things, finding ways to entertain yourself, because there was no, obviously I'm also very old, so there was no video games or internet or television or nothing. It was a bunch of kids in a big high rise entertaining themselves.
What was the language?
Me and my best friend wanted to have a secret sort of secret dialogue. So basically we did, you know, like Japanese looking shapes for the alphabet. So then we had like a dictionary of shapes.
Do you still have a secret dialogue now as an Aussie living in New York? Like you can say things like Arvo and they go, what?
Oh, yeah.
Or you can say yeah, right?
I worked with my partner back in the day was Amy Hollier, and we worked in Paris together for 5 years, and whenever, you know, everything was done in English. But whenever we kind of wanted to have a sidebar, we'd really get into the awkwardness and be like, who the fuck's a dude in a green? It should be Adam Blunt, you know? And no one would understand what the hell we were saying.
Yeah,
so you could almost have a sidebar in English.
Yeah, I mean, even in New York, I think you can still do that, you know? You can still
absolutely
pull the Aussies and they know what you're talking about.
And so you felt you were, when you were developing your own language and you were having to be inventive with how you entertained yourself and so forth, did you feel like, oh, this is interesting, I'm doing this, I'm self-identifying here as being creative and working things out, or was it just what you had to do? Or when did you start to think, oh gosh, I can make a living out of being a creative person?
That's such a good question. I think we were all very creative. My parents were very creative in just the day-to-day runnings of life. How to get food, there were rations, how to get us out of the country. There was no rhyme or reason. So you really had to hustle and find creative ways just to get through life, right? So I think we were naturally, instinctively doing that. But at the same time, Iranian people are very academic people, like education is super important in our culture. And, you know, I remember earlier on, it's like, oh, what do you want to do? I want to be a creative person. Like, well, you can do that in your spare time. Like, that's not, you know, it just wasn't there was no opportunities to like go be a filmmaker or whatever you wanted to do. So all through school, I was a math, oh my God, I sound American, and maths major. And then sort of very quickly in year 11 and 12, I realized, gee, I want to be more creative. And honestly, I changed this is old, so I don't even know how it's done, but you know, whatever, 30 years ago, you remember you used to fill out your uni sort of preferences and then like print out in the age. You know, I remember like the age was that, and we're all like looking at it. My dad's like, graphic design, visual communication. We didn't talk about that, you know, because it was going to be architecture or engineering. But I'm like, yeah, I just changed it. So it was like a bit of a fluke, but I remember I went to an open day at RMIT and it blew my mind because we went to the engineering department. But I just remember there was like a crowd in front of this sort of mechanic arm, right? And he was picking up boxes and stacking them. And everyone was oohing and eyeing. And it was like the project that the first year engineering students had spent a whole year writing. And I just remember looking at it going, that's cool, but I don't want to spend a year doing that. You know, and I like broke out into a sweat. And then we got lost in RMIT and I ended up in like the graphic design department and everyone looked really cool and there was paint everywhere. And I learned the word gouache and I'm like, this is cool. Like, this is kind of where I want to be. So I showed up to an interview with not much of a portfolio and bullshit at my way in.
What's the word gouache? You know, what does the word gouache mean?
Gouache is a type of paint.
Ah.
So, you know, you've got acrylic paint, you've got oil paint, and you have gouache. And that's, you know, the whole thing. If you're a design student, you quick gouache. It dries very chalky and matte.
Great. And is gouache part of your life now?
No, I haven't seen gouache since my RMIT days, but it was.
So an Iranian-born woman growing up in Australia and now finds herself in New York, we have to kind of look at that as and it just kind of addressed the diversity in the room. What role do you reckon that diversity or having lots of different influences plays in the creative process for you?
It does a lot. You know, do you remember back in the day when Mother started, it was all about we bring different people from different nationalities and blah together, because I think it's nice to be exposed. We're creatives, right? And we respond to the things we see. We're influenced by the things we're surrounded by. So if you surround yourself with different people, I think just naturally things go in a different direction. So in my sort of experience, I've dealt with different people, different languages, different cultures, all of that. I do think it makes me a better creative person.
Do you seek it out or does it just come to you?
You know, it's funny. I was always the odd one out, always. And a friend of mine sort of said, you have to embrace it. And this is years ago, even at uni, I just didn't, even, you know, Australia, it was great. I was always popular in school, but I was always a little off, a little odd, a little on the side, you know, a bit weird. I still am, and maybe it's not to do with anything to do with my background, it's just who I am. And even at uni and even in life, it's good to be different. And so I've learned to embrace it and like lean into it, as we say these days, and not be afraid of it.
I was always, I reckon the advice I always try to give people now is just try to fit in. Like everyone, there's so much pressure to be different, to find your space. But I reckon there's also a huge advantage in fitting in and knowing how to go along with.
That is such boring advice.
Do you reckon?
You can tell your kids to fit in?
I reckon fitting in is super important. Once you fit in, once you know the rules of a game, then you can stand out, then you can break them. But if you try
fitting in teaches you, but it doesn't it teach you strategy too? It's kind of cool. Like, how do you fit in? Like, you have to.
It teaches you influence. Yeah, it teaches you power.
But don't you want to find your own individual difference and then work out how to fit in with that? I'm sure you're really enjoying. Sure you're really enjoying watching Adam and I have a debate while you just.
I love this.
But I don't know. I would never tell my kids to fit in.
Well, let's just see how your kids turn out.
Adam, I love that. I've never heard of it that way.
And also for you as well. So, or for all of us, I just wonder if you learning how to fit in, or you coming to Australia from somewhere like Iran, which would have been somewhat of a culture shock.
Absolutely.
I can imagine your brain processing, gosh, the rules have completely changed here. What do I need to do to fit in? And then you're probably pretty good at it for whatever reason. And then you could be different and explore. But without that fundamental foundation of knowing, of working it all out, life gets hard quickly.
I actually think that's super smart, and it's an amazing observation, because the first thing you want to do is make friends, right? And how do you make friends? You fit in.
That's right.
And then once you've done that, then you can be your kooky self. So I actually think, Adam, you're 1,000% right, because now you have friends.
That's why he's the consumer psychologist and I'm the humble marketer. But did you feel in that sort of fitting in process in Australia, you know, we love sport in Australia, was your creativity almost sort of squashed a little bit when you first come to Australia? Or did you actually find the opposite, that you actually found you could really express yourself and really be creative here?
Can I tell you a dumb story? First day at school, because it's summer, right? It was school sports and I didn't speak a word of English and people kept on putting their hand up. Teacher was saying something and I'm like, what's going on? And the kid next to me said, like, do you swim? You know? And I'm like, yeah, I swim. And he's like, look. So I entered myself in every single freaking category of the 50 meter this and the 100 meter that. And they called my parents and my parents were like, all right. And so they forced me to go and like swim. And it was horrible talking about fitting in. I just remember the woman said to me, oh, it's freestyle. And I was like, okay. All I understood was the word free. So I breaststroked in a lane of like 8 kids. And you know, I came third breaststroking in a freaking freestyle thing.
So that's fast.
Let's celebrate that, right? Because I was so nervous and whatever. But then I realized they couldn't even disqualify me, because freestyle actually, I don't know if you know this, you can swim any stroke you want. It's just that that freestyle stroke is the fastest, and that's how that's become freestyle, is what I understand.
See, that was a creative response. See, yours a creative response to the challenge.
I cannot.
That's gorgeous.
So I didn't answer your question. I didn't answer your question. I think creativity is just a way of thinking.
Yeah.
Because we call ourselves problem solvers and all that sort of stuff. And I've always been that. I've gotten myself out of trouble. There's always a creative way to do something. And I've always done that. Now, in the traditional sense of like sitting down and being able to illustrate or draw, well, that sort of stuff came a little later, but I think the creative thinking was always part of just who I was.
Let's fast track now to your current role and your creative process now. Part of that role, do you find you're getting paid to come up with ideas still, or is it all about outsourcing the creativity to others?
I feel a responsibility to always have an idea, because ultimately, it stops with me, right? So I always, they can roll their eyes at it, like whatever it is, but I show up with ideas. I roll my sleeve. I'm not the kind of sort of CEO that goes, you guys go like execute this, you know, and like force my idea. But I throw my idea on the table. At least I can start the ball rolling and then obviously they'll top it and better it. And
if it gets better, then fine.
Absolutely, bloody better.
So what is your creative process? And this is kind of a bit where lots of people kind of start to balk and start to waffle and kind of go off course here. But we really want to try to unpack really top creative people's creative process and try to make it practical. So the more you can put it under the magnifying glass and help us work it out, the better.
That's a really interesting question. It's a tough question to answer. I'm a very visual person. So I look at a brief and I don't know how to explain it. Words pop out and maybe it's dyslexia, whatever it is. Certain things rise and I literally walk away with an idea of the brief. And always straight away, things come from all sorts of different places in my head. And I see an idea more than I have an idea. I don't know if that explains anything.
How do you capture those images that are coming to you? You draw them or do you find reference? Or
yeah, then it becomes, and I get a sense for the idea. I get, give you an example. Years and years ago, I stole a brief off a printer at Cummins and Partners, and it was for a new route for the airline. You know, they were going to Rockhampton from Brisbane or something. You can run this. Okay. It was for a new route, right? And I remember thinking, oh, that'd be cool to see a plane in the sky, in the new skies in Brisbane. So the idea ended up being a sticker that I stuck on windows where if you were sitting inside and you looked out the window, you saw a plane in the sky.
That's super simple. I love it. With that, yeah. It was interesting about the brief because briefs are always superfluous and written in words and boring. Do you wish the brief was in pictures?
I don't think pictures. I just think a very clear idea, sentiment, problem, insight, because then you start to solve for it, right? So when the brief is 75 pages deep and there's not really that much insightful human behavior in there, I find it difficult to, then I walk away.
So out of all those things, insight, sentiment, problem, what is the most useful? What are you looking for?
I think firstly, you have to understand the brand. So a clear picture of the brand, clear picture of if there is a problem, the problem or the ask. And then as much behavioral insights, different agencies have different names for them, for those things. If what's going on in social, what can you jump on? What do we call them here? I don't even know. Sparks, whatever it is. Help me understand the audience and how they behave, because then I'm able to find the clash where it works between your product or service and the audience. This is why I spend hours a day on TikTok.
And then what?
Well, and then you find ways to bring that to life, to solve for it, or talk to that's fresh and fun and interactive, and that the people want to interact with.
So you know the brand, you've got these wonderful little, you know the problem, and you've got these wonderful little sparks or human behavior insights or whatever. Then put a magnifying glass inside your brain. What's happening, or what stimulus are you trying to put there, or what are you trying to do to develop an idea?
How do you now, what's a fun, creative, entertaining way to shine the light on either on that inside? Hey, you do this. Have you tried doing it with this thing? It has to be entertaining. It has to be fresh. It has to be all those things. And then there's a whole layer of us being creative snobs. Hasn't been done before, all of that sort of stuff. So there's all these sort of pressures on your shoulder, but it, would I send it to somebody? Would the audience share it with somebody if it's not me? If it's my mom, would she send it to me on Facebook? Whatever it is. So first and foremost, is it going to grab someone's attention? Because we're not watching TV anymore in the old ways. You're not sitting there and you're forced to watch an ad. You were not making wallpaper. I think wallpaper is the worst thing you can make. And 80% of what we make, unfortunately, becomes wallpaper. And then we sort of talk ourselves into going, oh, yeah, that's good. No one gives a fuck about advertising, right?
That's a great place to start. That's a great place to always start.
That's right.
I want to go back to something you said. I spend hours a day on TikTok. How does the chief creative officer of Ogilvy, New York, who has... I'm scared of what your calendar looks like. How do you find the time? When do you do that?
I honestly don't sleep much. I have a two-year-old, so I'm up very early. And whenever oftentimes my partner will roll over at 4 a.m. and he just says, please put TikTok away. He doesn't even look at me. He knows I'm awake and he sees the lights, and then I put my phone down. So I might roll over and just to see what time it is, and before you know it, an hour passed and I'm like, oh my God, on TikTok.
And is that literally the place you go most for inspiration and find the most inspiration?
It's sort of inspiration. It's entertaining because it's anything and everything, and it's weird people and just random shit. It could be anything.
But you know it's an algorithm feeding back your interest, don't you? So you know there's a reason why it's got all that craziness, right?
Why am I watching Hoofstalk at 4 o'clock in the morning? Have you guys seen Hoofstalk's first episode? Like, why am I watching this? It's fascinating.
And do you say to all your creatives, get on TikTok? Is that one of your, you know, things that you want to see creatives doing?
I'm surprised if they're not, you know. I was at my new boss who just left, Chris, CBH, we call him. We politely sort of sat in a room together, and after 15 minutes, he was like, come on, let's swap bones. And so we swapped TikToks I wanted to know what he was getting fed, and he wanted to know what I was looking at. And there was like a little nod. And he's like, oh, yeah, cool. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know.
Oh, God.
TikTok snobs.
I hope we never swap TikToks.
Adam, we've never swapped phones.
No. So you're disgusted with your creative teams who aren't on TikTok. Well, how else do you get that? So that's your process, and we didn't get into the execution, but that's okay. We may talk about that later. How do you get your teams to have creative ideas?
I ask for an elevator pitch, right? Like if an idea, don't make me a whole deck, just a page. The old write a PR headline, which is very crisp, right? It always helps, I think, for young people. Like, what is cool about this idea? Like, if you were to write a newspaper headline, this is a new thing. What is that? And it's give it to, and let's talk about it in an elevator pitch format. One idea per page, we can talk about it, bring as many as you want. You can almost, I remember as a creative, when you were presenting ideas, you could almost, as you were presenting, kill your own ideas because you were like, this one sucks.
Just on that, have you ever actually had someone pitch you an idea in an elevator?
Yes. Somebody by the elevator cornered me like 2 weeks ago by the elevator and literally said, hey, I want to do this thing and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, that's fucking cool. Can you just go rogue and grab a team and do it?
You're one of the few people who has had, it's one of those funny things. We call it an elevator pitch. Yet I've never had anything pitched.
We've actually done it.
Have you tried it?
We've orchestrated it with a client and did the elevator pitch.
How'd it go?
I
hope it was more than like 3 floors.
Yeah. I think it's
I was going to say, we're on the 34th floor, right?
Yeah, right. We're on the 4th floor. Hey, so how do you get them to come up with the ideas? Do you see that as part of your responsibility to make sure that they're developing?
I don't think so. Everyone's got their own technique, right? Like are you a morning person or are you a night person? Do you need to walk around? Back in the day, I used to go outside and smoke, take a break, look at stuff. You know, there were creative directors that would tell you, you're not allowed to look at award books. You know, I don't care how you, my knowledge hopefully is well enough to go, don't rip something off. But if you need inspiration, I don't care. Everybody works differently.
Let's imagine Ogilvy's really, really struggling and you haven't had any good ideas and you need to get the agency to have some better ideas. What do you do? How do you get more creativity out of what you got?
I've done this. I do sprints, whatever you want to call them. I get everyone together and I give them a brief and I say, all right, let's catch up at 5 o'clock and don't fucking stress. And then they come in at 5 o'clock and we look at it again. And I'm like, see you in the morning. Like, see, and we do it in like 24 hours. And honestly, some of the best work I've done has come out that way.
And what about the culture that you're trying to build in your creative department? What do you think is important to have if you want to have, you know, have a creative department that's doing great work and you know, is a great place to work? What are the keys, do you think?
Gosh, you have to have fun, right? Like we're creative people. We're like children. You have to have a good time. We work so hard that I think if you're not having fun and you're not enjoying the process and working really hard, you don't come up with good things. And if there's a sense of spite, then good work doesn't come out. You know, often, and in my career, I've done my better work on even brands that I wasn't working on 24 hours a day because you kind of get to know the brand then, you know, and then it's like, they'd never buy this. So there's no way they would do this. So that, you know, and someone fresh comes in and they put an idea on the table and you sell it and the team that worked on that brand gets really shitty. So I think mixing things up, having a good time is what I'm all about.
And is that harder when you've got 150 creative people working for you at a place like Ogilvy New York? I mean, how do you keep a team that big? You know, how do you build a culture? How do you keep them creative? It's surely more of a challenge.
It's a really good question. And honestly, I'm quite new at this here, right? So there are, I don't want to call them pods, but I really rely heavily then on my executive creative directors and their meaning. And I think they have their own, kind of shitty now. I walk into a room sometimes and people go quiet, and I don't want that to be the case. You know, like if the kids are staring at you funny, and I'm like, what's going on? And you kind of forget that you happen to be the CCO, because I want to go hang with the kids and shoot the shit. They don't want me there. But I do that and show up with my dad jokes, embarrass myself, and then leave because I want there to be an open conversation.
One of the things I wonder if it stifles creativity or not is things like traffic, where certain people have to get certain briefs and then they get stuck with that. They have to solve that problem and other people are working on that problem, and it doesn't, you're not allowed to share problems, or the whole thing gets very mechanical very, very quickly rather than one big blob of creative energy.
Yeah.
Do you have a point of view on that? Or
I really do. And I always, you know, my first meeting here with the creative department was like, look, I encourage you to all go rogue and get me in trouble, right? So it's my piss people off. I don't care if it piss account people off, even if, you know, I'll be there to back you up, because just creative people are such sensitive people, and when agency's so big, you can get lost. So I'm like, do what you want to do. It's all about ideas. Bring them to me. Find me. I don't care. Annoy me. Go rogue, and I will encourage you to do that.
That's genuinely beautiful. That's fantastic.
This episode is brought to you by Mutinex.
Are you going to start talking about Mutinex again?
Yep. It's that amazing marketing mix modeling platform that helps marketers make better investment decisions.
I thought it was more complicated than that.
No, not according to the script. They measure the true impact of marketing on your bottom line using clever computers and people.
Mutinex Growth OS. Your best decisions start here. For more information or to request a demo, visit mutinex.co. That's mutinex.co.
We know Henry too. We had him on the show. Great bloke. 97% human, 3% cyborg.
Do you have an example of somebody who's literally gotten you into trouble or really done something they shouldn't have, where you've gone, oh shit, that they've taken it a bit far?
I've gotten in trouble, not in that way, but I've gotten in trouble in numerous agencies for stealing creatives, right? It's like, oh, that, like the person who cornered me last week had a great idea for a different brand, and I'm like, fucking do it, you know? And I like throw him into a client meeting, and they're like, well, you can't take him from that thing to this thing. And I'm like, yes, I can. And he had the idea. At previous agencies, you know, creatives would come to me and say, hey, I want to work on that brief. I'm like, knock yourself out. And I always realized throughout my career, if you're bringing the work, you can be the most obnoxious, difficult human being, and no one's going to do anything about it because you bring in the work. Not that I'm saying be an asshole. I don't like assholes. But, you know, like I worked on some really tough brands, and I just kept on bringing in like strong ideas that we couldn't sell. And so it wasn't, at the end of the day, the conversation wasn't like, oh, she sucks, we need to get rid of her. It was like, oh, that brand, right? Let's put her on something more interesting, because then we can sell more interesting work.
And in those situations where you're bringing strong work and it's not getting up and it's not getting through, like, how do you keep going? How do you build that resilience? Like that, because that is such a hard situation to find yourself in as a creative person who wants to make stuff, right?
Absolutely. Look, another thing that I tend to preach, and it sounds so dodgy, but, you know, we're both psychiatrists here, so maybe he'll agree. People always ask me, what's it like to be a woman in advertising? And I never saw it as a problem. And maybe it's because I'm an idiot and I'm naive, but I just found ways around it. So this is the same thing. Like it takes a certain type of person, I think, to be a creative in this industry. And you can see that very early on, that person is not cut out for this, right? And the type of person that hangs out still feeds off that energy and that awesomeness that comes with coming up with a great idea and selling it. So I don't, like, I might feel sorry for myself for 5 minutes, but then I'm off to the next thing. Or I'm trying to sell it to somebody else, you know?
I can remember years ago, maybe 15 years ago, I took a person who was junior in the agency with me to a meeting, and they showed me their ideas before the meeting. I said, no, we're not going to present ideas. We're just going to listen. And he had written the ideas with a pen on paper. And I said, no, don't show those. We're not going to do that. And so we're in the meeting with the client, and it was the first time we'd had the meeting. It was the first meeting. It was actually taking the brief. And and then at the end, this chap called Julian, and he'll know I'm telling this story, then said, oh, I've got some ideas. And this is great after we've taken the brief. And the client goes, oh, yes. Okay, all right. And he got out his piece of paper and he started reading his ideas before the brief.
Unless he like whiteboard it or something.
Exactly. Oh, God. And anyway, the client ended up saying, great, well, yeah, okay, let's do it. And it's just, I just love it. I just love the fact that he's gone rogue and he's now become very successful. And I just love that encouragement of people going rogue.
Yeah, break the rules, right? Like the rules are there to be broken.
Oh, there are no rules, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Be respectful, but break the rules.
So given that you've got this real sort of rebellious spirit, right? Go rogue, fuck the rules, all that sort of stuff, which is great. Chief Creative Officer of Ogilvy, New York? Talk me through that. Well, just in terms of like, you know, Ogilvy, New York is like such a, it's the establishment,
such
right?
An
it's
old school, traditional, it's boring agency.
Well, not boring, no. I'd say iconic, storied. Jesus, Adam. But like, you know, it is.
It's unreal. It's a good age. I'm joking, by the way.
So I sat down on my first day, and this is a quotation book of David Ogilvy, and my office is full of like, you know, there's old ads here. There's a little Coke machine. I have a little like Audi, you know, so it's all the brands. This thing is the most un-PC, fabulous fucking book. And these are all quotes from David Ogilvy.
Do you have a favorite to read out to us?
I wish I'd bookmarked some because I like flick through and I'm like, oh, you can't do that today. Whoa, that's a bit rich. Like it's so good, you know? So in my mind, you got to go back to the spirit of a brand and reinvigorate it, right? And so I like, you got in trouble, I'm gonna get in trouble. I'm gonna be respectful.
And what drew you to the job? What made you want to take on that position? I mean, you haven't been there long, as you're still pretty new. Like what made you want to do it, and what is your biggest challenge as the CCO of Ogilvy New York?
There's some really good people here, right? So when conversations were happening with, whether it was Liz Tyler, CBH, you know, it goes as far up as Rob Riley. It's people that I really admire and trust that were talking to me. So that was one thing. Also, then you look at the brands on the wall. Like I remember walking in here, I was very excited. Then I had a little anxiety attack because you look at the logos on the wall, there's Coca-Cola, all of them, like, all of Coca-Cola, whatever the brands sit under. Then there's Samsung, there's IKEA, there's IBM, there's there's a bank, there's H&R Block, there are Perrier, San Pellegrino, like every freaking brand that you probably dreamt your entire life, that was in correct English, that you would like to work on is in this building. So that's amazing, but at the same time, I'm like, oh my God, the pressure, like Jesus Christ, you know? But that's I came for that. And there's good people here and there's good brands. You should be able to do good work.
I really like Ogilvy and always have. And one of the reasons I do is because of Rory Sutherland, who's going to be another guest on this series. Does his work and what he espouses infiltrate the creative departments of Ogilvy, or is it more external inspiration for the world?
No, I think all the work does, because we, like any good network, we're proud of everything that happens, right? We don't forget we also have like David as a side agency. So the one thing I don't see enough of is work on the walls, and maybe I'm old fashioned that way, but I love walking the corridors and seeing stuff on the walls. They call it blackboarding here or whatever it's called. So I want to do a bit more of that.
Do you mean work you've made or work you're making on the walls?
A bit of both. Yeah. A bit of both. Like, you know, old agency, shit went up on the wall.
Yeah.
And you went and stuck something next to it or moved something, or like you'd go by it the next day and going, well, that's gotten better. You know, shit, where'd that go?
I agree. I think putting the work you're making up as opposed to the stuff that you've made, I think is a really confident gesture from AC, you know?
Agree. And the stuff that you've made circulates anyway, right? Yeah. Because we all see it. There's always internal, there's always, what do you call it? Like creative showcase meetings where there's booze and they show the work and everyone's really proud of it. And we do it with the network. We do it all. So we all see each other's work.
But Warren Brown, who's a good creative.
I know Warren Brown.
Yeah. He always used to talk about leaving his ideas on the edge of his desk. So if he had an idea, he would just leave it on the edge of his desk and he wouldn't mention it, and then people would always just comment on the idea. So he would get an unfiltered perspective, And I enjoy that. Yeah, I enjoy that.
It's a bit harder now. Everyone's working from home. Where do you leave it on the
internet? No, they're not. They're back, baby. It's only, they're back.
Hey, we want to talk about a bit of work you did before Ogilvy. We like to sort of really spotlight one great piece of work for each of our guests. And we absolutely love the McEnroe versus McEnroe idea that you did. Can you, for our listeners, just explain that idea?
Yeah, sure. So let me go back. So the brand Michelob Ultra, which is a low-calorie beer, right? Their whole the strategy behind the brand, which I actually really love, is they go after athletes and they sponsor athletes and they go after like sports because they believe that you can be a winner but have a good time at the same time, right? So I made that very Australian. It's better language. I can't remember. The whole thing is like you can still be extremely successful but enjoy a beer. So Little by little, they started to do really, really good work. And McEnroe came about because we realized that, for example, tennis was one of their big tentpoles in the year. And we were thinking about like athletes that are known for not enjoying necessarily the sport. And obviously, John McEnroe, I grew up playing tennis, watching tennis, playing very badly. I was at the Australian Open sort of smuggling my way in to the front, to the front row every year as a 15-year-old. And I was actually at the Australian Open the day he got kicked out, watching him play. So I was just a very big fan. And so we thought, okay, how cool would it be if he came back and played a game against himself and reflected back on his career and actually talked about it, right? So we didn't know how to make it. It was honestly, it went belly up 1,000 times. We all lost many lives over it. But it was... And once we got there to the actual activation and he started to play against, like, there was a screen, there was a projection, there was, like, all this mapping that had been done before and it started to work. That was amazing to watch. But the thing that got me really teary is when we actually then sat down with him and interviewed him. And he looked back at his career and he started talking about the fact that he was a kid who grew up in the Bronx. I think his dad's a lawyer or was a lawyer. It was that whole, like, get up, man, and get on with it attitude. Like, oh, you have an injury, fuck that, get up, go to training. He said there was no, in his generation of players, there was never really, that wasn't allowed to take time out just for any sort of break, right? He said he had a kid, he wanted to spend time with his kid, and he really got like crucified for taking time away from tennis. So it was actually really nice to watch him speak, and he's an idol.
What I love most about that description of the idea, you didn't mention the word AI once. So, but get into that a little bit.
Because it wasn't about that.
No,
right?
It's not. No, no.
That.
Got, like,
right. It's a
exactly.
tool.
The best work is about the idea, not the technology that you know, brings the idea to life. But this one did have some pretty incredible technology behind it, right? Like how hard was that to create the virtual McEnroe who could actually play the game? I'm sure it took a lot of planning and a lot of really smart tech work.
What I find really funny is that when we first spoke this an hour ago, you were mentioned that arm you hated seeing as an engineer, and all I can think of is that arm is in
the robotic tennis arm.
Can I tell you, Adam? It looked exactly the same. And like if I had sat, if my job was to sit and program that arm for fucking 4 months, it just forget about it. You
but
know,
you'll take it.
So I'm glad I'm not. But you know, it was so dumb. Like you do all these tests, right? Like I'm like, okay, so how are you gonna? What are you gonna project on? Like, is it smoke? And then you see a smoke test. Well, that doesn't work because the ball goes through the smoke, and then it disperses, and you lose the projection. So then you go back, and you're like, two days later, they show you a different test, and you're like, okay, water, and that works. And I'm like, guys, you know, I know I'm the only person who's like a big tennis person, but the ball's going to get wet after, like, you have to change the ball every. Then he's going to hit the ball, and it's not going to feel right. And it's like, oh yeah, shit, right, okay. So then it ended up being a really light mist that was oily enough to be heavy. It was unbelievable the things that we had to think about that you wouldn't normally have to think about.
And that's amazing craft, right? Like I think we see a lot of ideas that use technology and they all kind of feel a bit the same and they all, but there's this beautiful craft in that we've really thought about how does this need to look? How does this need to feel? Right?
Like, how do you have the audacity to be the person making that craft decision of what's the thing the ball should go through? Like, that you're not skilled at that.
No, not at all. And you have really good people. There's like three production companies on this, and we had an amazing client. Like that client I miss him, Ricardo. Hi, if you hear this. You know, trusted the agency, and we'd done enough work with him. You know, we did the bubble with the NBA thing with the year before, and he just trusted the agency. And the thing that I liked about our team, we were not failing. Like, failure wasn't an option. So everybody just worked and worked and worked until we got there. Down to like, oh shit, like we have to edit this thing, and we had like a week to edit the 1 hour content. So we were on like 24-hour shift rotations sitting in Zoom edits, you know.
And you mentioned the client, Michelob Ultra, of course, is a brand of AB InBev. And we've all seen this incredible journey that AB InBev have been on, where they've kind of gone from being, you know, a pretty average beer marketer to being the can marketer of the year 2 years in a row, never been done before. I've certainly studied that journey pretty closely, and there's a lot we can learn as marketers on what they did. But just give us a sense of that, you know. How did they change? What had to change at AB InBev for them to start being a more creative organization and doing that kind of work?
Look, Marcel, the CMO, super visionary, right? And he put it out there. Like he 5 years ago, whenever it was, he put out a statement to his people saying, hey, we want to be can marketer of the year in 5 years. And then little by little by little, it's just the work got better. And every brand hopped on the bandwagon. And before you know it, all agencies are scratching each other's eyes out to work on all their brands because they were inspired clients.
And what were some of the practical things they did inside differently that you saw them change in regards to how they approached the work?
I think they valued an idea. I don't know how else to say it. You know, quite often, like, I see decks and it's like 25-page deck, and honestly, there's like 5 Grand Prix like hidden in a deck. And I always like sort of, guys, strip it back and take the 3 good things and make them as big as you can possibly make them, and have the clients visualize what you're visualizing, how big and amazing this thing could be. Don't be scared. And I think they can see and recognize a big idea, and they're ambitious. I think that's a good way to talk about it. They're ambitious. They love advertising. Well, they see the value in it.
Speaking of Grand Prix, we do like to award work, and the Macaron versus Macaron stuff won something or other.
It didn't just win advertising awards. It won an Emmy as well, right?
That's true. It won
a sports Emmy, which was wild because it wasn't like the advertising. Yeah.
But let's see. We have a thing here called the pub test where we show people in a pub various bits of work.
I love it.
Yeah. So let's see if it won the hearts of the Australian consumer in the pub test.
There you go. So it's about beer. I didn't catch that until the very end, but it's a pretty cool idea. He's one of those characters, you know, you kind of love to hate. It's funny seeing him in a situation like this.
I really liked it. Thought it was a cool concept and sports advertising and, it's really clever.
I think it's a great concept. Really interesting. Like, the use of technology seems cool in this.
How it relates to beer, I don't know, but, hey, got me watching. And, it's one of those things that it's just exciting, I guess.
The beauty of sport, right? The humanity and the, like, mistakes and the striving to do better, be better, and...
Sport's getting crazy these days, isn't it? And I guess, you know, there's, like, this crossover between sport and technology. The crossover between sport and technology does seem to be a good place for brands to position, you know? It's an exciting frontier, and I think sports fans are really interested in that kind of stuff, so...
Yes, I do think it passes the pub test.
I mean, yeah, like I said, I thought it was pretty interesting, so I guess it's good creative. It made me feel excited.
I think it passes the pub test.
Oh, cheers.
Yeah, that's good. And I think that's the first one this series.
Forget winning a lion.
Forget winning a universal pass.
Forget winning a lion, just pass the pub test, right?
Like, two interesting things.
I love the pub test.
Two interesting things for me on those results there. We don't hear them until it's played. Was where's the beer? So I guess the platform's been pretty well established in the US, so maybe that's forgiven, but I would like your opinion on that. And the second thing is, sport is pretty tribal, and tech is screwing with sport a lot. And to do that idea, there would be a lot of purists, and there would be a lot of people who go, oh, God, just leave the game alone and just let us enjoy McEnroe play Borg or whatever it is. Yeah, what are your thoughts?
Well, listen, you're right. The beer, I think the brand has enough. He did have a beer at the end, by the way, but the brand plays in the sports arena enough for people to kind of recognize it as a sponsor of sports in general. Your second question, I wanted to all the comments, I agree. AI cannot replace a player, but we had to. This wasn't about a game of tennis. This was about a person playing themselves at their best in their career and reflecting back on their career and talking about that. And there's no other way to do that. There's no two McEnroes in the world, right? So we did everything we could using technology and AI and what have you to replicate him at the years he was the best at. So actually one of the years he didn't win anything. Some of the other years he was number one, blah, blah, blah. So that how cool would it be if you met your younger self? And that was the 2000 and whatever the year it was, 20-something version of your younger self. I can't imagine how awesome this would be in 5 years' time with the technology. But it wasn't about, hey, this is what tennis is going to look like. This was just a tennis player's clash with himself.
So you said AI can't replace a sports person. Can it replace a creative?
You know, I think eventually probably, because right now, like the dumb things that it's replaced is now it takes you 5 seconds to pull a beautiful looking deck together. Whereas in the past, you were killing yourself, retouching stuff. And, you know, and now you just, oh, I don't want that, change it to this. And you don't have some poor schlep in the studio who hates your guts because you changed your mind about, you know, the outfit the person was wearing. And now they have to sit there and build a new image. I don't know. I don't want to. Did we all think we were going to have the internet? I can't answer that.
Do you use AI to generate ideas yourself?
No. I don't think the way it is right now. And I don't think AI is ever going to replace people. And because of that, people and their eccentricities and the way they were creative is always going to win one way or another. Or AI, or it'll become the most futuristic picture where they're slaves and who the fuck knows? What will be 100 years down the track.
You know it's listening to you right now. You know AI is listening to you now. It's coming to get
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. But coming, hello, AI. Coming in.
Coming back to your, I like what you said about, you know, it certainly can replace all that time we spend on decks and stuff, right? Like isn't that exciting for you? Because instead of doing decks, creative people are actually thinking about the ideas.
Doing ideas.
Thinking about the bit that actually makes the difference. The bit where we need that incredible leap that I think only a human being can make. Right? Like, that's the exciting bit, right? Does it free creative people up to sort of actually focus more on the ideas?
I have never been afraid of technology, and that you just got to jump on it and lean on it and, you know, be a human, be smart, and use it in an interesting way.
Samira, we've just about run out of time. We might do something a little bit differently today, though. Do you mind just wrapping up for us and just telling us the highlights of what you've covered today?
Are you outsourcing your job to the guest?
I thought it could be fun. I wouldn't mind hearing what you have to say, what you think is the most important thing. I'm
gonna walk away with you saying you tell your kids to fit in, because you actually really nailed a behavior which is so true. Like, when you're trying to fit in, you develop so many skills that then you can put to use later in life, and you make friends. You know, so we're all so busy trying to out-creative each other, right? Even when it comes to what you're wearing and and this is maybe why I'm always in black. I'm trying to fit in. I'm going to walk away with that. But you guys are awesome. Like, thank you for having me. I hate talking about myself, but I just learned something which I'm going to credit you for, but use.
hey, one more thing we like to do, because the podcast is called Black T-Shirts. If you were going to sum up your creative philosophy and put it on a black T-shirt, what would it say?
Because I asked Samira to sum up our show, can I do hers?
Oh, wow, we're really flipping things.
Why don't we let Samira tell
us, and then you can share what you would. Is that
okay,
right, Adam?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah?
That's fine.
Yeah.
I think my T-shirt would just say be uncomfortable.
Would the T-shirt be uncomfortable? As well? No.
If you wanted to, yeah. It could just be uncomfortable.
It could just be too tight, too big, different size sleeves.
A little scratchy.
See, that's a bigger idea. You make the T-shirt uncomfortable. See, there's an idea in
there. There is. I like it. Mine was just going to be go rogue.
Go rogue, yeah.
Go rogue. Yeah. And I reckon there needs to be more encouragement of that.
It's really interesting, though. The tension, though, there's a real tension in what you just said about the power of fitting in. and yet also go rogue, break the rules. I think there's a really interesting tension in what you've talked about today. And I think you're able to balance both those things equally, which is interesting, right?
You because can only go rogue if you fit in.
Right. Or go rogue in a way where you still can fit in.
The more you fit in, the more you can go rogue.
Yeah, although exactly. but that's interesting, isn't it, right? Because if you try to fit in too much, you're not going to be very rogue, right? Like, so it is interesting that can you sort of hold these two opposing sort of things, you know, at the same time, which is like try and fit in because that's super useful and helps you influence and all sorts of stuff, but also hey, be a bit rogue and break a few rules. That's interesting.
Yeah.
God bless you, Samira.
Samira, thanks so much for your time.
Miss Hong, thank you for having me. I really loved it.
It's been awesome talking to you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you both. Have a good day. Have a good morning.
What are your thoughts? Oh, you didn't like her. Oh,
fuck off.
Come on. What did you think?
Surely the best thing to ever come out of Doncaster.
nice save. Great. We've covered charisma, but again, great charisma.
Yeah.
Feels like radiates creativity.
Yeah.
Love the idea of just encouraging people to get her in trouble. Asserts her as the protector in a kind of quite a maternal role, isn't it? Like, I'm the protector. I'll take it up.
Yeah.
You get me in trouble and you're doing your job.
Which surely, makes creative people walk taller who work for her and feel braver and, you know, really go for it. There's something too about the most creative people we've talked to keep it really, really simple. And they're not into decks and they're not into complicated explanations of how it works. I mean, spend any time on LinkedIn and you read all these, you know, very detailed, overthought, over-intellectualized explanations of how creativity works. But when you talk to proper creative people, it's kind of really simple, right?
Yep, I totally agree.
How do you think getting her to sum up worked?
Good. She repeated something I said, so yeah, I couldn't be happier.
She also called you a psychiatrist. Did you notice that?
I did. I know. I just got a...
Maybe that was therapy for her.
That was a move to the left or to the right, but I don't think I don't ever want to be a psychiatrist.
No.
Take care. God bless.